Chapter 13, Psychotherapy as the Way to a New Civilization. Why is Freudian-Jungian depth psychology important? Isn't it out of date? It has gone out of fashion with people who prefer more spiritual pursuits for their personal growth. But as I have already pointed out with spiritual bypassing, one's childhood traumatic experiences must be resolved before one is free to concentrate on more spiritual disciplines. More than that, psychotherapy can be a spiritual journey in itself, as was explained by M. Scott Peck in his enormously successful book, The Road Less Traveled. But he wasn't aware, and most psychologists aren't aware, that the culture in general isn't aware of the discoveries I made that showed me how psychotherapy can lead us to a new civilization. After I had successfully completed psychotherapy, to the satisfaction of my psychiatrist, I spent 10 more years actively working on my psychological development, using dream analysis and free expression, scribbling, until I myself was satisfied that I had reached psychological adulthood. In that process, I discovered how human nature itself could be changed to create a society that could truly be called a civilization, along with a few other things that aren't generally known. My experience is described in my book, Reeducating Myself. But because my discoveries are not part of the cultural awareness, I feel that I must take a few pages to describe them, to show where the culture might go if it was not blocked by the invalid arguments of physicalism and psychological defenses. To start with, I think I need to explain what I mean by a new civilization. And why. In the summer of 1953, when I was 19, and had just finished my freshman year at Harvard, the Soviet Union exploded their first hydrogen bomb. Suddenly, the two major powers had both the motive and the means to destroy each other and threaten all of human life on Earth. Within 5 years, the word overkill had to be invented to mean that both sides had many times the destructive power necessary to destroy each other and probably exterminate the human species as well. Suddenly, warfare became unthinkable. The manly virtues of fighting and warfare, which had been instilled into every boy child since before recorded history, and had been instilled also in every girl child, insofar as she learned to respect and admire the men who protected her, suddenly ceased to become virtues and became negative forces that could destroy us. We needed a whole new way of thinking. In 1954, when I was 20, I was thinking about what I wanted to do with my life. My father and grandfather before me had worked to make money. I already had the benefit of that money, but I wasn't happy. This may sound like a personal problem, but it isn't. I was the end product of the American dream. The promise of America is that people are free to work their way up to a level where they have money and material comfort, if not for themselves, then for their children or grandchildren. The implied premise in this is that it will bring happiness. Certainly it will bring happiness compared to living in poverty, but indoor plumbing, electricity, central heating, radios, television, cars, boats, summer places, money in my pocket, and social status did not make me a happy person. I had to abandon the American dream, not because it had failed, but because it had succeeded. There was more to happiness than it offered. I had to find a new standard of living. Also, because I had already reached the goal of the American dream, I had to find something else to do with my life, new goals and a new way of life. It seemed to me that the happiest people were those who had developed their full potential as human beings, regardless of what that potential was or whether they were successful by cultural standards of money, power, and fame. So I set out to develop my human potential in search of happiness. The following year, I studied The Wasteland by T.S. Eliot. This had been presented to me in two different English courses as an important piece of 20th century literature, but also as apparent madness, as in, this won't be on the exam. I wanted to resolve the question of why, if this was apparent madness, was this an important piece of literature? It was a depressing experience. The old religious beliefs from which we had derived our values had collapsed, leaving 20th century humanity stumbling amid broken images, living boring and meaningless lives, and working at boring and meaningless jobs. After about 3 weeks, I finally understood what was so depressing. The Wasteland was my world. I was living it. I looked to T.S. Eliot for a solution to the problem, but all he offered was, "Shall I at least set my lands in order?" That wasn't a solution. I was the model boy, much admired and respected. I was fine. It was the world that was a mess. But that was the only solution he offered. And the more I thought about it, the more I could see that it was a solution, and perhaps the only solution. Efforts to change other people would result only in resistance from them, unless they wanted to change. But if I wanted to change, I could change myself and change my small fraction of the world. This was also consistent with my goal of developing my potential as a human being. In 1955, at the age of 21, because of these cultural problems, especially the threat of nuclear annihilation, which I saw as total systems failure of the culture itself, I turned my back on the culture, as represented by the 7 million books in the Widener Library, and set out to design a new civilization. New civilization was the best expression I could think of to mean new values, new beliefs, new ideals, new goals, a new standard of living, a new way of thinking, and a new way of life. A civilization is not just buildings and cities and large numbers of people, but it is based on a set of fundamental ideas that determine what those people choose to build and how they choose to live their lives. The civilization, to me, was what had been programmed into my head as a product of the American upper middle class. To create a new civilization, all I had to do was change that programming. Of course, this was much more easily said than done. In 1956, my senior year at Harvard, I applied for Navy Officer Candidate School, OCS. This had been my plan all along, to avoid being drafted in the Army, but also, semi-consciously, I was using their comprehensive and stringent testing as a kind of self-evaluation. I passed the dreaded physical exam, which many a star athlete had failed because of some minor physical disability. They told me I qualified to be a fighter pilot. On their mental exam, they told me I had received the highest score they had ever seen at their Boston headquarters. This was in competition with other students at Harvard, MIT, and all the colleges in the Boston area. This answered my question, who am I to be designing a new civilization? Nobody I knew of seemed to be qualified by virtue of education or experience, so that made it a question of raw mental ability, and my raw mental ability had just been acknowledged by the culture. In all fairness, the Navy test was biased in my favor. In addition to the usual mathematical and verbal sections, It had also a mechanical section, which tested one's knowledge of boats and the maintenance of boats. I know I got a perfect score on that section because I had already worked summers on a sport fishing boat, in a boatyard, and as a professional sailing master. But the test told me what I wanted to hear at the time. But on the mental history questionnaire, I answered yes to the question, "Are you often depressed?" This led to an examination by a psychiatrist who diagnosed me with mild chronic anxiety, but said that this would not prevent me from performing my duties as a naval officer. A friend quipped that a little anxiety was just what the Navy wanted in a junior officer. But because the class was oversubscribed, I was rejected because of this abnormality. Wiser heads told me I should not have answered yes to that question. They didn't know that I was using the Navy's screening process as a self-evaluation. I had been turned down for a job because of a psychological condition. The intellectual part of me had been educated, but the psychological part of me had not. So I saw psychotherapy as a necessary part of my education. And as it turned out, psychotherapy also led me to a new civilization. In hindsight, it is obvious that it would, in a culture where most people have an intellectual education, but not a psychological education. Actually, my psychotherapy started with my study of the wasteland. This was the hardest thing I had ever done in my life at the time, because to understand the wasteland, I had to be able to see myself and my life. We are trained in our intellectual educations to look outside at external objects, but not inside at ourselves. It is as hard as seeing one's own face without a mirror. I remember being taught in school that Socrates said, "Know thyself." But what that meant was never explained. It was just something we had to memorize. Self-knowledge was simply not a part of the American culture in 1955. I learned to look upon myself from on high. This is not out-of-body travel, but simply separating my mind from my ego and seeing myself as a person down there doing foolish things and struggling with the problems of life. This was a good warm-up exercise for psychotherapy. Even so, psychotherapy was the hardest thing I ever did in my life at the time. I have said in two published books, psychotherapy is the way to a new civilization. That isn't exactly true. Drug therapy isn't the way to a new civilization. Also, I think that most psychotherapy only brings people from subnormal to normal. A new civilization is something beyond normal. Also, not everybody succeeds at psychotherapy. In order to succeed at psychotherapy and to reach a level that I call a new civilization, I had insights that I didn't read about in books. So it would be more accurate to say psychotherapy as I experienced it is the way to a new civilization. I want to share my experience with psychotherapy with emphasis on those aspects of it that were different from the prevailing cultural view. First of all, I want to define psychotherapy as I experienced it and as I use the word in this book. Psychotherapy as I experienced it means resolving one's childhood traumatic experiences and growing to an adult level of behavior. Historically, this has been achieved by talk therapy, as differentiated from drug therapy or psychopharmacotherapy. But there is always the possibility of new and more efficient methods being invented. Of course, there is a whole range of psychological problems that professionals have to deal with, starting with outright insanity. But I am focusing here only on the relatively mild disorder that I experienced, insofar as it is representative of the condition of the normal person. I define psychological wellness in terms of appropriate behavior. Appropriate behavior means behaving in such a way as to achieve the desired results. It means channeling the raw energy of one's physical drives through one's mental circuitry in ways that improve as one grows older and wiser. You might think of it as programming, as creating software for living. It is the supreme creative activity, the creation of a human being living up to one's adult potential. A perfect example of appropriate behavior is that of Martin Luther King Jr. When provoked by police brutality, he didn't try to fight back, and he didn't submit to physical domination either. He did exactly what was needed to succeed at winning his civil rights. People have been debating whether psychotherapy is science or art or religion. I see it as education. I had had 19 years of intellectual education, but psychotherapy was emotional education, to develop the emotional circuitry in my brain and mind to produce appropriate behavior. It is more closely related to philosophy than to medicine. The child, with the child's mind, is confronted with an overpowering situation with powerful emotional content, fear, pain, and/or anger. The child doesn't understand, doesn't know what to make of it. The child has an unresolved problem in living, in philosophy, if you will. But the problem is filed away in the child's mind, consciously or unconsciously. And into adulthood, the person is driven, usually unconsciously, to keep recreating the same situation over and over until the problem is resolved. This is the traumatic experience. And the resulting fixation, as Freud defined it and as I know it. As part of recreating the same situation over and over again, the person must preserve the same childhood self, at least the same attitudes and levels of psychological development. This is the inner child that everybody knows about. So the whole idea of therapy is that the adult with the adult's mind has a better chance, not a sure thing, of resolving the problem than the child with the child's mind, if only he or she could remember the details. Mental disorders were described in the mid-20th century as mental illness to get away from the stigma of demonic possession. It wasn't as if you had consorted with the devil. It was like being sick. It wasn't your fault. But that didn't work. The stigma then became attached to being sick. The idea of mental illness was somehow associated with the medical model. The brilliant doctor was going to analyze you and somehow make your illness go away. Before I began psychotherapy, I had read a great many case studies showing how the brilliant analyst made a brilliant diagnosis. But if that was the diagnosis, then what was the cure? They never explained that. In therapy, I began to see it as a problem and a solution, rather than a diagnosis and a cure. Once the solution is found, the problem goes away. In the medical model, the brilliant doctor performs the operation, and the patient is only a piece of meat to be operated on. Psychotherapy doesn't work that way. The client must solve the problem. The client must do the analysis. The client has all the necessary information in his or her own head, although much of it is in the subconscious and jealously guarded. The proper role of the therapist is only as a guide, to recognize the tricks and traps of ego defenses and employ whatever strategies are necessary to enable the client to solve the problem. If the brilliant analyst sees the solution and presents it to the client before the client is ready to accept it, the client's ego defenses will reject it. I see no mention in the literature of psychotherapy that the client has to solve the problem. I think that this one misunderstanding is the main reason that psychotherapy usually fails. First of all, the client expects the doctor to solve the problem. Second, the client treats the doctor as an authority figure, as in, I can fool the shrink anytime I want to. And third, the client senses on some level that he or she is being exploited to support the therapist's ego props when the therapist takes the credit for success. This creates resentment, and therefore a bad working relationship. This can actually be a traumatic experience in itself. There are vestiges of authoritarianism here. The therapist is not the authority, like a teacher or a doctor. The therapist is only a guide, keying in on the client's defenses so that the client can find his or her own way to his or her own inner truths. The therapist is not the idealized parental authority figure, although the client, who is still psychologically a child, will put the therapist in that role, and the therapist, if not psychologically mature, may be playing that role without actually being aware of it. I think psychotherapy would be successful for many more people if the clients understood that it was part of the cultural awareness that it wasn't the therapist's job to solve the problem, but that it was the client's job to reach deeply within themselves and find their true selves. When I first began therapy, I was sitting one day trying to find my real self, and the self I found was my 4-year-old self. This was the self that I identified with. I felt it was the real me. So, of course, I was uncomfortable and anxious, trying to relate to adult women and trying to find a job in New York City. But being 4 years old psychologically did not make me freakish in the eyes of the outside world. I appeared normal. I had graduated from Harvard, had served honorably in the Army, and was hired out of 75 applicants for my first job, at which I was successful right from the beginning, still psychologically at age 4. But deep inside of me there was this child I'd been hiding for years, and once I recognized this child, it was a great relief. He was free, free to exist within my own mind, and free to develop and grow up to become an adult. I have asked a few people if they could find their childhood self that they identified with, or a time in their lives when they really felt they were a real person. 2 identified themselves as age 11 and 8, respectively. This is within the normal range, as I shall explain later. Psychological age 4 is below the normal range, but this was still not conspicuous in my case, as I have said, so I am wondering whether you can find a real self that you can identify with at some childhood age. The idea of the inner child was in, and then became a cliché, and then was ridiculed by people who were embarrassed to admit they had an inner child. Don't let those other children intimidate you. The concept of the inner child is important and serious and must be preserved. Let's move this up to a higher intellectual level. I remember people using the word existentialism during my college years and beyond, roughly 1954 to 1964. They used it to show how intellectual they were, but when asked to define it, no two people ever gave the same definition, and I don't think any of them knew what the word meant. This is what I think it means. I think it was 20th century humanity struggling to make the assertion, I exist. It was the first assertion that such a thing as a real self even existed. The Jane Austen novels are wonderful documentation of how totally artificial people's lives were in an earlier century, totally dictated by social roles. The child is told to share his or her toys with other children and told that this is good. The child doesn't want to share his or her toys, so the child believes that he or she is inadequate and abandons his or her real self for an artificial self, and beyond that point, begins playing a role that society has scripted for him or her, like playing a part in a movie. Being everything the establishment wants him or her to be, just the opposite of psychiatrists are tools of the establishment. Psychiatrists can free you from being a tool of the establishment. Existentialism was an attempt to break out of this total artificiality and assert that a real person existed in there somewhere. Existentialism can't really be explained intellectually. It has to be experienced by finding that real person. Intellectualism has been defined as a psychological defense, as a way we have been trained to use our minds after many years of intellectual education. Discussing the real self intellectually won't find it. The real self is found by looking and feeling to find out if it feels real. My psychiatrist kept asking me, "What are your feelings?" Most of the time I had no feelings, actually, but feelings are the key to knowing whether it is a real self or an artificial self that one is looking at. With intellectualism comes abstract language, such as existentialism, actually. Abstract language is always ambiguous because everybody has their own unique set of specifics that go into creating the abstraction. Many people's definitions of existentialism will differ from mine. To avoid the problems of abstract language, my psychiatrist insisted that I speak in specific language, describing specific actions and thoughts. Not, I had an existential experience, but I found my real self at age 4. After 3.5 years, my psychiatrist told me I could end the treatment. He thought I was okay. I was normal. I felt normal, although I felt that there was still something missing. I stayed on for another year because I felt dependent upon him until my company moved me to California. A year later, I was back east in Provincetown, which had been my family's summer home for generations, ostensibly to write my philosophy. But actually, in the solitude of Cape Cod winters, I was able to build a philosophy. I experienced withdrawal, as defined by Arnold Toynbee in A Study of History, and experienced by Henry David Thoreau on Walden Pond and Isaac Newton at the family farm, where he observed the falling apple and formulated the law of gravity. In the solitude of Cape Cod winters, away from the cultural din, I was literally able to hear myself think, and this became the greatest creative period of my life. I had learned about Carl Jung from a Provincetown artist, because Jung was hardly mentioned in all the psychology books I had read. In December 1966, with the help of my 9-pound dictionary, I read the basic writings of C.G. Jung. I asked myself, where did he find his archetypes? And the answer was, in dreams. So I set out to explore my dreams in search of archetypes. But the dreams had an agenda of their own. They picked up where my psychiatrist had left off. They showed me that I was still only 10 years old psychologically, and that this was normal for the culture. The discovery that the normal person is psychologically 10 years old can be and should be as important to the culture as Newton's discovery of the law of gravity. But I'm sure that there are academic people with PhDs who are psychologically 10 years old, who will fight it with all the ingenuity that their psychological defenses can produce, at least when they can no longer ignore it. I thought that when I became psychologically normal, I was psychologically an adult. But my dreams were telling me that this was not so. And just to reinforce the message, there were some 10-year-old boys in real life who wanted to play with me. So here is another confusion in the field of psychology. The word normal means average, in the usual sense, and the word normal also means psychologically well. But these are not the same thing. Yes, normal means that a person is not insane, but normal is a long way from being psychologically mature or reaching one's true adult mental potential. The good news is that the average adult in the United States is operating with only his or her 10-year-old mental potential and has something to look forward to in reaching his or her true adult mental potential and the quality of life that goes with it. But the psychological profession does not currently recognize that true adult mental potential. Their goal right now is only the halfway point, the normal, the average. I want them to tell me that I'm wrong about this. I reasoned that if I was only 10 years old psychologically, then maybe that explained why my sex life wasn't as good as I imagined it could be. I theorized that if I could reach the psychological age of puberty, or psychological age 14, my relationships with women would improve. So using the disciplines I had learned in psychotherapy, I set out to analyze my dreams, picking up where my psychiatrist had left off, with that goal in mind. People don't understand what I mean by the disciplines I learned in psychotherapy because they think that the analyst does all the analyzing and the subject is only an object. But if a subject has to solve the problem, I am sure it can be understood that the subject needs to learn certain disciplines, recognizing one's defense mechanisms, recognizing one's rationalizations, being able to see oneself and recognize one's faults, learning to look for details and not just philosophizing, knowing the kinds of things to look for, and so on. In 1966, interpreting one's dreams was unheard of. I asked myself, what will happen if my interpretations of my own dreams are wrong? Will I sail off into some wacko land? The dreams themselves answered that question. I was having some dreams that I interpreted as homosexual. One about the dentist, the guy who puts his tool in your mouth, and another about a fire in the corporate chimney. I thought that I might be homosexual. I was adjusting mentally to an identity as a homosexual when I had the following dream. A beautiful woman is lying on a couch, naked, absolutely drooling with desire for me. As I start towards her, suddenly I am in a car full of boys, teenagers, or homosexuals, driving around town and having a wonderful time. But all I wanted to do was get out of that car and get back to that woman. Finally, with a supreme lunge, I get out of the car and wake up. It was such a powerful dream that for a week afterward, I was trying to get back into that dream and back to that woman. That answered forever the question of whether I might be homosexual. Also, it answered forever the question of what would happen if my interpretation of my own dream was wrong. If your interpretation of a dream is wrong, the dreams themselves will correct you. This is a logical extension of Carl Jung's description of dreams as a compensation for, or correction to, the conscious attitude. If your interpretation becomes part of your conscious attitude, then your dreams can correct it. I am leaping here from the particular to the general because in 1991, when I presented my paper on the self-steering process at the annual convention of the Association for the Study of Dreams, ASD, I learned that many of the dream workers there were familiar with the self-steering process already. What nobody seemed to know at the time, and I didn't learn myself until 2004, was that Carl Jung had mentioned it in a paper in 1931. Why it hasn't been published in popular dream books, I don't know, because it makes self-interpretation of dreams an accurate source of knowledge, which rivals science itself. It used to be that only the analyst was considered qualified to interpret a person's dreams. But actually, given the self-steering process, dream analysis works best if the person having the dream also interprets it, given some grasp of the necessary disciplines. I saw this reflected in the ethics statement for the 2013 conference of the IASD. Workshops conducted in a manner that implies that the leader is the authority on the meaning of the dream rather than the dreamer are unacceptable. Getting back to the winter of 1966-67, I had to tell the first PhD psychologist I saw about my discovery of the self-steering process, and her reply was, "I don't think they would agree with you." This is the caste system speaking. This is a person playing the role of the idealized parental authority. Actually, they don't even study dream analysis anymore. So what do they know? You can read about my dream winter in detail in Re-educating Myself. I did reach psychological age 14, the psychological age of puberty, and my sex life did improve as a result. That transition point was marked by the following key dream. It was my first day in the Coast Guard. The waters had risen, burying man, woman, and child under 120 feet of water. It was my job to go out in a very small dinghy and mark the spot so that other people could rescue them. There were huge 14-foot sharks in the water. It was almost certain death to go out in such a tiny boat. There were larger boats, but I hadn't earned the right to use them. I was to be married that afternoon to the beautiful young woman I had met in the supermarket the day before. I didn't want to die when suddenly I had so much to live for. Two older Coast Guard men stood patiently holding the boat for me, waiting for me to make my decision. As I stepped into the boat, I woke up with a jolt. I was ready to sacrifice my life for man, woman, and child. The number 14 was a hint that this was psychological age 14. This is the psychological age of puberty. This is a transition point in human psychological growth, where human nature itself changes from the exclusive self-interest of the child to an equally natural drive to give and share and sacrifice oneself for others. This can be explained in terms of survival of the species. The survival of the species is not only the survival of the fittest, meaning the survival of the individual, but it also involves the survival of the greatest number of individuals. Survival of the species is best served if the children, who are the most vulnerable, look out for their own interests. But when they become adults with children of their own, it is more appropriate that they should be motivated to give and share and occasionally sacrifice themselves for the survival of their children and the greatest number of human beings. If my discovery that the normal person is psychologically 10 years old is as important to the culture as Newton's discovery of the law of gravity, then my discovery of how human nature itself can be changed should be as important as discovering how to undo the force of gravity. Can the culture be changed this way, or was this true only for me? I had only the one dream, telling me that the normal person was psychologically 10 years old. That is not much evidence to support extending my discovery to the whole human species. But remember the self-steering process. I have held this view as part of my conscious attitude since 1967, and my dreams have never corrected it. And you can help me by looking for the childhood self that you identify with. Also, my view is consistent with economic and political reality. The American system of competitive self-interest works because it is in tune with the level of psychological development of the average person. The more altruistic systems, such as socialism, don't work because the average person is not ready psychologically to function at that level, and the forces of self-interest dominate. Unlike physical growth, psychological growth is not automatic. Most people's psychological growth is arrested before they reach physical puberty, and they never reach the psychological age of puberty in their lifetime. But if a majority of people were to reach this transition point from competitive self-interest to altruism, we would have a new civilization. That's how psychotherapy, as I experienced it, is the way to a new civilization. We all know about altruism. Altruism is nothing new. But there is a difference between playing the role of altruism as an actor in a movie and actually being an altruistic person. Reaching the psychological age of puberty means actually becoming that person to the depths of one's being. I think our cultural ideas of morality and altruism came originally from people who reached this level of psychological development and beyond. But this level of being is not achieved by forcing children into artificial roles, but in letting them be children and letting them grow naturally to psychological adulthood. I continued to work actively at my psychological development until I reached psychological age 18, or the psychological age of adulthood. At that point, I felt totally competent as an adult and comfortable with myself, and I was not motivated to develop myself further psychologically. Richard Kininger has written that it is possible to keep growing psychologically to psychological age 28, acquiring psychic abilities such as controlled clairvoyance. My concept of psychological age is my original creation. Richard Kininger discovered it independently. It is not the same as Freud's or Erikson's stages, or Maslow's hierarchy of needs, or Kohlberg's stages of moral reasoning, nor is it derived from any of those systems. The idea of psychological age has the advantage over all those other systems in being numerical, which means that it is measurable. Unfortunately, I don't have either the qualifications or the credentials to design a test of psychological age, so I offer the idea to anyone in the field of psychology who might be inspired to do it. The field of psychology has documented human physical development in exhaustive detail, but I see no indication that what I call psychological, mental, behavioral, philosophical growth has been documented in the same way. One way of measuring psychological age would be to measure the ability to differentiate, which I found improved as I developed psychologically. When I tried to tell a PhD psychologist about the psychological age of puberty, she said, Maslow must have said that. Foolishly, I made it my job to find out where Maslow had said that, and discovered that there were 17 publications by Maslow listed in the Dartmouth College Library catalog. That made the task impractical. I should have laid the burden of proof on her, since she was the expert in psychology, and she was the one making the assertion about Maslow. I should have insisted that she back up her statement with a book and page reference and an exact quote. But for the moment, her bluff worked, and she was able to brush me off. Actually, I was being doubly duped here. Her implied assertion was that if Maslow had said the same thing I was saying, that would give her an excuse to dismiss what I was saying, whereas actually, this would support what I was saying. Did Maslow say what I'm saying? I leave it up to scholars to really answer that question. But judging from the brief description of his thinking and his approach that I have seen on the internet, he did not, nor would he have been likely to have made the same discovery that I did. First of all, there is no mention of a transition point where human nature itself changes from competitive self-interest to compassion and altruism. He wouldn't have observed that anyway, because I see no mention that he observed people in the process of psychological growth. He studied famous and distinguished people in their fully developed state. His thinking was theoretical and abstract, whereas I made empirical observations of the changes in motivation of one human being, myself, using my mental senses. I saw the word altruism once, and compassion implied in a long list of attributes of self-transcendence. They are only mentioned. There is no mention of how important these attributes might be towards his vision of world leaders sitting at a peace table. Instead, he bypasses these attributes and emphasizes peak experiences as the most important attribute of the highly developed person. I've also seen cosmic consciousness mentioned. These things bring to mind the psychedelic drug experience, not the gradual growth process experienced in psychotherapy. The whole idea of self-transcendence implies going beyond self, which again is reminiscent of the loss of ego experience in an LSD trip. Psychotherapy is a process of strengthening the ego, or the real self, as differentiated from the ego compensation or the psychological defenses of the artificial self. The real self is never transcended. So I would say that Maslow was much more aligned with the hippies and their psychedelic drug experience than with anything I'm saying about psychological growth and maturity. They would say that their view is superior, but I would say that my view is more likely to lead us to world peace and survival of the species. Also, the whole idea of needs implies something consciously felt and some conscious motivation to do something about it, whereas psychological growth, such as the transition experienced at the psychological age of puberty, happens without any conscious idea of what it is going to be. For example, I had no idea that my selfish desire for sexual pleasure would be satisfied by attaining attributes of compassion and altruism. So, the representation of Maslow on the internet gives no indication that he might have discovered anything like the psychological age of puberty, or even that his thinking and approach would have led him to make such a discovery. And with this long discussion of Maslow, I see that I have been duped in yet another way. Getting involved with Maslow has created a diversion which distracts attention away from what I am saying. Whether or not Maslow might have said the same thing makes no difference to the accuracy and potential cultural value of what I am saying. So let's get back to what I am saying. My dreams showed me that the average person is using only his or her 10-year-old mental potential. Continuing my psychological growth beyond normal, I experienced a transition point where my human nature actually changed from a basic motivation of competitive self-interest to an equally natural motivation of compassion and altruism. This is not theory, but is empirical evidence observed by me through my mental senses. I am a sample size of one, not significant in itself, but waiting to be combined into a significant sample through meta-analysis. I am hoping that persons with scientific credentials will recognize how important this discovery would be if it were true, instead of just trying to dismiss it. Getting back to overkill, nothing in our Western culture prevented us from entering into an arms race and following it through until we had developed the minimum destructive power necessary for the extinction of our own species. I say minimum because certainly our technology will develop more powerful, more efficient, and more certain ways of making our human species extinct. And I learned after I had been working on the problem for years that I was doing something that used to be called philosophy, before Western philosophy deteriorated into some kind of useless intellectualism. I say useless because Western philosophy has not, to my knowledge, provided us with any solutions to the problem of imminent extinction. Well, actually, British philosopher Bertrand Russell sent off telegrams to Kennedy and Khrushchev and other world leaders during the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. He might have prevented World War III, but with diplomacy and common sense appeals to reason and restraint, and not with anything out of Western philosophy. But Sigmund Freud developed a method that could ultimately save us. A few years before Einstein published his formula that could ultimately destroy us. Of course, the culture has no idea how that is possible. It is not known that normal people are functioning on only their 10-year-old mental potential, that their human nature itself would change to compassion and altruism if they were to function with their 14-year-old mental potential, and if that majority's in the major powers were to reach this level, they would elect leaders of like kind who would have no desire for an arms race, but only for whatever might serve the greatest good of humanity, starting with the survival of the species. Einstein's formula was developed into overkill in barely 50 years, but Freud's methods have been met with constant objections and have not been allowed to develop to its potential. First, Carl Jung was branded a mystic, and his improvements on Freud's method became limited to a small following. Then the insistence on physical evidence made Freud's method look unscientific. Freud did bad science, it was said. Freud was demonized and made to look like a bad person, because Jung's improvements were known only to a small following. Freud's methods had to stand on their own without these improvements and were vulnerable to criticism. Whereas young people, such as myself, had achieved personal growth through Freudian methods in the early 1960s, a generation that discovered the spiritual in the late 60s had to go to India to find the answers they were looking for, because they didn't find answers in Western civilization. If Jung's openness to the spiritual had been well known, they might have stayed with psychotherapy for personal growth, but instead they switched to the ancient Eastern disciplines of meditation and yoga. I fault Western philosophy for not recognizing Freud's discoveries and methods as part of philosophy. Socrates said, "Know thyself." Freud showed us how to do that. I define philosophy in terms of a question. How shall I live? Socrates defined it in a more authoritarian way. How should we live? In either case, Philosophy is the application of the mind to the living of life. The fact that we sometimes do things that we don't consciously want to do indicates that there must be an unconscious part of the mind, and to the extent that this unconscious determines how we live our lives, it should be included in philosophy. Recognizing it, dealing with it, bringing it into consciousness, correcting the inaccuracies it creates, and developing the mind to its adult potential are all legitimately part of philosophy. Not the philosophy of the ancient Greeks, but the philosophy of our present time. And all of these things are accomplished through psychotherapy. Given that the human mind is unreliable, we have a method called science that helps us to obtain accurate knowledge. But also we have a method called psychotherapy, which helps to make our knowledge more accurate. Given that the human mind is unreliable, make it reliable. Both of these methods can work together to achieve what I see as the primary goal of philosophy, to maximize the scope and accuracy of our knowledge. Western philosophy talks about the good life. Certainly, psychotherapy helps people attain the good life, or what is now known as quality of life. Western philosophy defines itself as the pursuit of wisdom. Wisdom, as I see it, is a long way from the ongoing intellectual argument that is now Western academic philosophy. I see three components to wisdom: accurate thinking, knowledge, and the ability to differentiate. This third attribute is developed in psychotherapy. The psychotherapy that we, the type 1 clients, were undergoing in the early 1960s was really philosophy. We were all able to function in the real world. What we were looking for was quality of life and greater wisdom than our academic educations had given us. And going up the line in human psychological development, compassion and altruism are certainly important factors in how one lives one's life. And a controlled clairvoyance is certainly important in expanding one's capacity for knowledge. So all those things that psychotherapy offers are legitimate aspects of what philosophy should be. Western philosophy should have assimilated the teachings of Freud and Jung and all the developments in the field of psychotherapy as important contributions toward the pursuit of wisdom and achieving the good life. I think academic philosophers argue that psychotherapy rightfully belongs in the field of psychology, not philosophy. I would agree that practicing and developing the methods of psychotherapy belong in psychology, but undergoing psychotherapy belongs in the domain of philosophy. I am shouting this because I think that the psychological defenses of so-called educated people prevent them from even thinking that they should undergo a process which they may associate with a lower caste of people who aren't able to function in society. But I hope they will learn, as I have learned, that this development of their adult mental potential is as important a part of their education as the intellectual education, which they now think of as the only kind of education there is. So it seems that my value system in turning my back on the culture has some value. It has enabled me to discover things that the culture is not aware of, or actually to rediscover things that the culture has lost, forgotten, ignored, dismissed, confused, or deemed unfashionable, such as philosophy. This is not the philosophy of the ancient Greeks, but a philosophy which is alive and is able to incorporate more recent cultural innovations, such as psychotherapy, which in turn offers a very real solution to a major problem in the living of life: the threat of nuclear annihilation. Academic philosophers say that if I am working on practical problems, I am not doing philosophy. Because they have the status, they get to determine what words mean. So I have thought that I should coin another term, such as software for living, for the application of the mind to the living of life. But no, this is philosophy, in the oldest and broadest sense, and should be called philosophy. What the academic philosophers are doing should not be called philosophy, but should be called something like the history of Western philosophy. And even though these academic people have the power to say what words mean, those of us who can think for ourselves can understand that only a small fraction of what should be called philosophy is actually studied or taught at our American colleges and universities. We have this wonderful technology, created mainly by science, and at the same time, we have cultural opinions, attitudes, and beliefs that have created weapons that can destroy us, or at least bomb us back to the Stone Age, as people were saying in the 1960s. The personal development of human beings has not kept up with our technological development. Some of the blame here is on the scientific establishment for holding us to a physical view of reality. We need to break away from this physical view. Physical science is just fine in dealing with the physical, but physical science should not be allowed to dominate to the point where it obscures our view of the mental and inhibits our mental development. It has been more than 50 years now since my discoveries of the self-steering process and the psychological age of puberty, and all these things are still not known to the culture at large. Part of the problem is the rejection of Freud and the dismissal of Jung, so my whole knowledge base has been undermined. Another part of the problem is the domination of the scientific establishment, who dismiss any knowledge that did not come from the in-group. My personal experience is called personal, implying that it doesn't apply to anyone else. My evidence is considered anecdotal evidence because I don't have scientific credentials. It is considered to have no referent because it is based on the evidence of the mental senses. According to the scientific establishment, it doesn't exist.